Welcome to Conversations with a Wounded Healer. I'm your host, Sarah Bueno. I'm a psychotherapist, teacher, consultant, and most importantly, a wounded healer, living and working in Chicago, Illinois.
And I'm your host, Anne Remy. I'm a counseling psychotherapist, yoga teacher, and trauma specialist living in Brighton, UK. On this show, we interview folks in a variety of healing professions, and we discuss the intersectional journey of healing self while caring for others.
But we're not just focused on individual healing, but also healing on the collective level, from white supremacy, late-stage capitalism, and the patriarchy. Thanks for joining us. Hello, Anne.
Oh, hey, Sarah.
Oh, hey. How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm good. I'm enjoying your beautiful bangs.
Thank you.
The audience can't see right now, but my dogs have something to say about it, too. They like it as well.
Yeah, well,
yeah,
they're cute.
Yeah. So we're going to tell you a little bit more about joining us on Patreon. But
and my bangs.
You can see Anne's bangs on Patreon.
Fringe, if you're British.
In March. Fringe, if you're British. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Miss Jackson, if you're nasty.
Amazing. Okay, we've got a lot of stuff to talk about today, so we should probably get to it. So this intro isn't 100 years long. Mm-hmm. Okay, so all the exciting stuff we have to get to, but first, the stuff that we always talk about, which is how you can support us. Yay! Because we are independent podcasters, and so every little bit helps. So if you want to buy some cool merch, mm-hmm. we've got some stuff over at tinyurl.com/CWHmerch. You can rate and review us on Apple Podcasts, which we're going to tell you about a very exciting thing you can do with that momentarily. Mm-hmm. And you can see Anne's fringe/bangs if you become a Patreon supporter. I believe it's $7 a month that we are asking for you to watch. Anne and I are having conversations, and I think this month we're going to be putting up an EMDR session mm-hmm. that you are doing with me. Mm-hmm. So we haven't done that yet as of this recording, but I have mm-hmm. a feeling it's going to be fun.
Trauma's fun.
I mean, I'm all for like sharing my trauma therapy experiences. So
I think it's fun.
Yeah. So now to the really fun, exciting thing is, mm-hmm. guess what, you guys? I don't know if you've been counting, but in May, it's going to be Anne's anniversary
of a podcast.
It's my name.
So we are celebrating this anniversary in a very special way. We're doing a giveaway for you. And so here's the deal with the giveaway. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. we want you to write a review on Apple Podcasts between this date, if you're listening to it on its release on March 6th through April 24th of 2024. Mm-hmm. So if you send us your review, then we will enter you into a drawing to win 1 hour sessions with both me and Anne. So I am going to be offering you the choice between a business coaching session or a Reiki session.
And I am offering either a yoga class or a travel consulting session, which may sound strange, but I promise will be very helpful.
It's hard to have therapists like be able to do giveaways because we can't give you a therapy session. This is part of the problem of our ethics, right? Right. So this is what we're offering. So here's how it goes. Between March 6, 2024 and April 24th, mm-hmm. 2024, go to Apple Podcasts, whether it's on your phone or on your Mac laptop. You search for Conversations with a Wounded mm-hmm. Healer. You click on the show and then you scroll down and you'll see ratings and reviews. Mm-hmm. You'll have to tap on another button that says write a review and tell us how you like the show. Especially tell us about how much you love Anne and how her addition to the team has just made your life wonderful. Then
it's going to do wonders for my low self-esteem.
It's really going to. Yes, it's going to support Anne a lot. And then what you do is screenshot your review and email it to me at sarah@headheartbiztherapy.com. Mm-hmm. Once we receive your review, you're going to go into a little tally. And then on April 24th, we're going to figure out who the winner is and we will reach out to you. And we'll also put it out on social media on May 1st. So get excited.
Yes.
Write us reviews. We're excited to be with you, be connected to you, all of it. So now on to today's conversation. Anne, what did you think? Because this one, I fucking loved.
I loved it. Was that enthusiastic? Because I am very enthusiastic about how much I love this.
Yeah. What struck you?
Well, so I think the thing that hit me the most was when Shelley was talking about being like kind of before she started her journey, thinking of herself as like one of the good white people who didn't have to work on anything and like, oh, those are the racist people over there. And you were kind of talking about your experience with that, being like, oh, I'm from Cincinnati. Everybody below us is racist, but we don't, you know, not us up here.
Right.
And right. And I think every white person will have their own benchmark of like who the bad ones mm-hmm. are and who the good ones are. And I had a really interesting experience with this recently. And I've, you know, this is something that I've been working on and I've actually named many times, like, you know, my kind of righteousness and being like one of the good white people and how I need to get past that.
Yeah.
And I got on a plane to Rwanda a couple of weeks ago, and I was the only white person on the plane who was not a missionary.
Whoa, that's a weird feeling.
And it was very clear that every other white person on that plane was a missionary, either by the way they dressed, the items they were carrying with them.
Wow.
And it challenged this thing in me so hard because I was like, you are not any better than them. And you need to really sit mm-hmm. in this. And it was so uncomfortable. And so I think that that never stops. There is this really innate thing in our white brains that always wants to keep us one of the good white people. And it's a protective mechanism. And so that right. I think that conversation, just hearing it again was really helpful for me. Remembering like this is just an ongoing process. And I think in general, her whole vibe of like this is an ongoing process forever is mm-hmm. just a good reminder for yeah. us all.
And I was just thinking about how good it is that I have a co-host that forces me to actually listen back to my interviews again, because I didn't before when I was like doing my solo episodes. Because as I listen, I mean, I remember feeling after this conversation just like lit up and on mm-hmm. fire. And I actually sent the raw unedited version to a couple friends of mine who we've been talking mm-hmm. about this. And they were like, yeah, this woman's mm-hmm. amazing. Shelley Touchluck. We haven't even said her full name yet, but we'll get to all of that. But I was reflecting on this place that we're in right now where there's this bounce back. We're distrusting science. Mm-hmm. We're distrusting people who've done it before because we're assuming they're part of the old mm-hmm. regime. But what Shelley really like made very clear to me is like, people have been doing this mm-hmm. work and we just didn't mm-hmm. know it. And so many of us in the social justice movement right now are newcomers, mm-hmm. right? Like, I really think I didn't start this work until 2018. Mm-hmm. So that's not a long mm-hmm. time, right? I don't have an embedded history. I think that culturally, we're starting to forget how important it is to listen to people who've come before mm-hmm. us and done this for a really mm-hmm. long time, especially when it relates to this, because I think there's just an assumption that if it didn't come up since 2016, that it's not valid in the anti-racism or social justice mm-hmm. space. But like, that's not true. I don't know if it's quite that mm-hmm. clear, but like, there's just a rejection of, I think, the wisdom of, I don't want to say elders because Shelley's not old, but she's an elder in this yeah. work.
It's interesting because I wrote a paper about this in my second year, I think, of therapy school. And there's actually a map for white people. Like, it's a diagram and it's old. Mm-hmm. I mean, the oldest thing I found about like specifically therapists need to be doing this sort of work, mm-hmm. white therapists need to be doing this work, is from the 1950s. Like, we were still mm-hmm. just giving people Valium and lobotomies in the 1950s, right. but they already were saying this. And I yeah. think that, if I remember correctly, that map was from the 80s. And it was the exact map that I had accidentally followed. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So I think you're right. There's so much that we've discounted. When I think about elders, and you guys kind of touch on this in the episode, like, white people need somebody to look to in this work.
Right.
And when we don't have that visibility, we don't have like a compass, we don't have like a guide point. And that's right. really what Shelley's work is providing for us.
And I wasn't able to download her book, Living in the Tension, because it's only available as a like physical copy, but I got it. And I'm reading it very slowly and trying to, I'm really trying to like soak it into my cells, because I really, really believe it's not like, oh, Shelley has the answer, but Shelley has channeled an answer to all of what is ailing our social justice movements right now. And I hope that people will listen, because I think she's right on.
Yeah. There was a lot of this, and I think the way that she presents it does not elicit a defensive response. So
exactly.
Yeah, I would challenge anyone listening today to maybe just keep an extra open ear.
Yeah.
Any white people listening. Let's caveat that.
And I mean, I don't think that people of color can't learn from Shelley's experience. Right. I think that's also part of it, too, is, you know, I guess what I want to say to listeners is see if you can locate yourself in the trajectory of the movement that Shelley is talking about. Right. Because she talks about, like, you know, people have been doing it for a while, people who are sort of in the middle and people who are new. And what I'm seeing is a lot of new people thinking that they know what's up and trying to tell people in different stages what they're doing right or wrong. And that's the shit that's got to change. So locate yourself, right? Like, I locate myself sort of in this middle area. Like, I am not somebody who has it all figured out, and I haven't been doing this long enough to have enough cred. So yeah, just think about that as you listen to it. But let me tell you about Shelley. You can find all of her books on the Head Heart Business Therapy bookshop on bookshop.org. So we'll make sure that all of those are in the show notes. But Shelley Tuchluk, she's a professor of education at Mount St. Mary's University in Los Angeles. She's an author of Witnessing Whiteness, The Journey Toward Racial Awareness and Anti-Racist Action, the third edition, Living in the Tension, The Quest for a Spiritualized Racial Justice, and co-author of Being White Today, A Roadmap for Positive Anti-Racist Life. She volunteers with Aware LA, which is the Alliance of White Anti-Racists Everywhere. And for 15 years, she co-produced their four-day institute called Unmasking Whiteness, which leads white people into a deeper understanding of their personal relationship with race, whiteness, and systemic racism. So please enjoy this deep and soulful conversation with Shelley Tuchluk. Hey there, therapist. How you doing? If you're like a lot of people out there, maybe you need a little bit more support than usual. Well, I've got you covered. I'm currently running two groups that I plan to run again in the fall of 2024. So add your name to the wait list to be notified as soon as info is available. First is the Burnt Out Practice Owner Support Group for group therapy practice owners. We'll focus on the emotional component of business ownership while building trust and connection with other practice owners. We'll explore topics such as boundary setting, feeling underappreciated, overwork, and find ways to reconnect with our agency. And you'll also have the support of other practice owners when challenges arise within your business. Next is the Authentic Leaders Group. It's here to help you become the authentic and wholehearted leader you aspire to be. Join me on an 8-month journey of self-discovery and leadership mastery, where you'll enhance your leadership skills and forge meaningful connections with fellow therapists who are committed to their own growth and the betterment of the therapy field. For the Burnt Out Practice Owner waitlist, go to www.headheartbiztherapy.com/burntout. Make sure you've got that T in B-U-R-N-T-O-U-T. And next is the Authentic Leaders Group waitlist at www.headheartbiztherapy.com/authentic-leaders-group. Hope to see you soon. Hello, Shelley Tuchluk. Welcome to Conversations with a Wounded Healer.
Thank you for having me.
I'm really, really excited to get to know more about you and your work. And I always kind of, I like to tell listeners how I find people, because I never want for podcast guests, because I just keep stumbling over people that seem amazing that I want to talk to. And I was, I think it was part of, I'm in Resmaa Menakem's, well, it just ended, but their Equity for Racial, Education for Racial Equity. And then just one of the white folks had mentioned your book. And then I looked it up and I'm like, oh my God, you've been doing all this amazing work and I've never heard of you. And so then I followed your, I got on your email list and you just share such great resources and it's such a rich, robust mailing list. So everybody go sign up immediately. And I'm really excited to get to know more about you and all the awesome things you're doing in the world.
Well, thank you for sharing that, because I'm really excited to know that one of my colleagues was out there talking up the new book. And yeah, the newsletter is very much a labor of love. It's one of those moments where I thought, you know, I don't always have a new thing to say in the world. I don't like to do blogs or social media so much. Yeah. But if I can amplify other people's resources that are doing great stuff in the world every month, it also keeps me accountable for staying on top of things myself.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, do you want to introduce yourself and what you do in a way that feels aligned with your heart?
Sure. My name is Shelley Cheshluck. I live in Los Angeles, and I am a professor of education at Mount St. Mary's University. I'm actually the co-director of the liberal studies program and concurrent program of teacher preparation. So I get to work with all sorts of young people who are going to be teachers. Our school serves predominantly young women of color. And that has been a beautiful journey to live into the mission and the spirit of the place. The Sisters of St. Joseph of Carondelet are a fierce set of activist women, religious. Mm. And although I am not particularly a religious person, I have come to treasure who they are and what they bring into the world. Mm. I say that as my intro to who I am as a working person, because that's my real job. And so all this stuff that we're probably going to be talking about in regards to race and racial identity and anti-racism, all of that is what I have done as pure passion project for numbers of years. And the crossover there, though, is that I became aware of myself as a racialized person that needed to pay attention to these issues when I was teaching elementary school. And so here I am, as a professor of students who are going to become elementary school teachers.
I'd love to hear that journey. And I know it's probably a long journey and hard to summarize, but anything you want to share about like that awareness and then how that led you into higher education, supporting people who were going to be elementary school teachers?
Yes. So I was raised in Orange County, California, which is about 45 minutes south of LA. And it's a fairly diverse area.
Oh, is it?
It is. It is and was. Even years ago, many decades ago now, when I was there in high school, about 40% of my high school was Latinx. About 40% was Vietnamese. I grew up in an area that was becoming Little Saigon. And that is the nomenclature of the current times. And 20% was Caucasian and or other mixed. And yet, my social experiences, my academic experiences were still largely with other white people because it was a tract school. And I didn't have as much crossover with people as one might have imagined with all that diversity around me, except for the fact that I was a sprinter. So strong athlete, definitely a jock, and pretty good at sprinting for the area. And so going to college, I was one of the few white sprinters on the team. And that is what brought me into direct contact with being sort of the minority in a situation on occasions. And so cutting out a whole bunch of experiences, I will simply say that through high school and college, I ended with a pretty strong sense of the world is not just for everyone. And meaning there's injustice affecting lots of people. And I'm so glad I'm not one of those bad folks. I mean, that's really what I took away from all of that lived experience that I was either observing or hearing about was, well, thank goodness I was raised by decent people and I'm one of these good white people. And so I don't have to worry about this racism thing on my end.
Right.
And I carried that with me into grad school and into a volunteer position at a local elementary school in Inglewood, California, which is a bit south of LA, really close to South Central area, and started showing up at that school to be of service, to be one of those good liberal-ish. Yep. I wouldn't have used liberal at the time. I didn't really see myself as a political being even. Mm. I just wanted to do good stuff in the world and figured my education and my good heart was going to help me be that person who was going to make such a difference in the kids' lives in some kind of way. And I was there for years as a volunteer. And then as a data analyst and counselor, mentor, that sort of thing. And then the program closed. And when it closed and all of the therapists and counselors were leaving, because I do have a psychology background, I was finishing a master's in counseling psychology.
Oh, okay.
After having a BA in psychology.
Oh, wow.
Heading toward a doctoral program. That was the plan. And as I moved through that experience, I had several years worth of deep conversation with one of the mentors and in that program who had really called me to see myself as a person who was showing up with a racial background and a class background that was preventing me from seeing what was actually in front of me and seeing how I was showing up. And that in and of itself is a very long journey of conversation. But suffice it to say that by the time I finished my work with that program, a couple of years worth of really deep searching and being called to account, but in a very loving way, I'm going to say, really important that the people that those individuals were aligned with and the organizations they were aligned with were deeply spiritually holding, deeply invested in healing and spiritual advancement of all people, and being significantly understanding of the dynamics. And so I was never asked to see myself as less than in that process. That was important for me. Because what it then allowed was for when I became a teacher at that school, once all of those figures had to leave because the grant ended, I stayed at the school, became a substitute for a year, then became a teacher. And at that point, I was still really trying to figure out, who am I supposed to be now that I understand that this is more than I thought it was? And a couple little pieces to add to that, just to wrap that piece up a bit, is that, because I know that this is speaking to a lot of therapists out there, I actually was planning on applying to a doctoral program. I had every intention of going into clinical psychology at the time, but I had seen so much that the schools that I wanted to go to, I wrote essays to get in that kind of blew up the individualized psychopathology approach and basically said that it was all wrong and that it wasn't understanding all of what these young kids were facing in terms of community violence and socialized, you know, environmental issues. And this was, again, a few decades ago. And apparently that is not the essay you write when you're trying to get past an admissions team.
Oh, funny.
And I knew I was shooting myself in the foot. I knew that I wasn't going to get in, but that was my ethic at the moment. I did not want to participate in the psychology of the time.
Yeah.
And so I just stayed with the kids and became the teacher who cared about psychology and brought my psychological process to then trying to learn how to be an elementary school teacher while I was being an elementary school teacher.
I love that so much. I absolutely love it. It also sounds like it was a really spiritual process for you. I don't know if you think of yourself as a spiritual being, but I do think that process of waking up to our racialized identities, especially as white people, I think has to involve some sort of spiritual reckoning, because it's a soul process. Like, if we're, and I don't want to say like, this is doing it right, this is doing it wrong, but I think that really doing it right, like, it has to be an embodied process, a soul process. Like, it's more than just a mental process.
That speaks 100% to me. I absolutely believe that it's an initiatory process with all of that language that comes with it. That is exactly how I experienced it. And in fact, just to continue how I came to the point where you would have heard about any work that I do, what ended up happening for me is that after teaching for a number of years, continuing to grapple, but at the time there was not any group of other white people doing this work. I didn't know where the access points were to learn how to figure out who I was supposed to be. This was in the mid-90s when this was all going on. Mm-hmm. And so I didn't have any language for any of this, but I just internally struggled and talked to people who were around me and doing my best. What I did end up deciding to do, though, was go into a doctoral program in psychology, but in-depth psychology at the
Institute. Oh, yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
That is a very spiritually oriented place, depending on who you access and how you access it. And so I took my deep spiritual sense of I'm trying to be the best human I can be with a very deep spiritual orientation to that location, and ended up doing a dissertation that was focused on how do I learn how to become the kind of white person that I need to be in order to be the most evolved person that I can be, with all of the sort of Jungian pieces of individuation attached to that. And in doing that particular work, I was walking a path that was in some ways not completely aligned with all of these, those mentors I had spoken about before, the ones who were, by the way, African-American men who had been part of youth mentorship work in Los Angeles, working with sort of gang-affected youth. So I was being sort of the mother hen to a group of men working with other young men, bringing people into more of an indigenous orientation to like reclaim that sense of self. I was observing all of this, watching these men get together through men's conferences, going deep into indigenous work that were very multiracial in context. And so there was this deep sense of poor humanity, of getting past the socialization in order to get to that deep human place and that deep community building place, while at the same time recognizing that they couldn't ignore the race and the class and all of the stuff that came along with it. So here I was then finishing up a doctoral program that I had been introduced to because of all of that work. But my choice was to go deep into the identity part. I had been really affected by the book by Beverly Daniel Tatum, Why Are All the Black Kids Sitting Together in the Cafeteria? That really was my opening place to, oh my gosh, what is really stopping me is the socialized whiteness. And if I don't learn about that language and learn about what that is, then all this other good stuff I'm trying to do in the world is going to keep running into a barrier. All these kids and their gifts, especially these are all young kids of color, are not going to be fully seen if we don't strip that veil of whiteness, that socialized whiteness that's getting in the way and creating all that do-gooder stuff that isn't really pure in its interactions. So I say all of that to answer your question, because my first book in the world came out of that dissertation, which is called Witnessing Whiteness. It's now in its third edition. It's been 15 years. Most people who know my work know that work. But the real answer to your question about the spiritual journey is the book I had to write next that nobody has read.
Well, I'm going to download it after this.
Which I think is a lovely book. It's my favorite. But the second book that I wrote is called Living in the Tension, The Quest for Spiritualized Racial Justice.
Yes, I am absolutely going to download that after this.
And it is my process of navigating the anti-racist collective that I joined to figure myself out at the same time that I was experiencing and participating within extended relationship with these men and women of color at this point who are part of this spiritual community that were telling me, you're paying too much attention to this white thing. And so I was having these very different inputs of where my attention should be. And so that book I'm telling you about was really this integration of how do I pay attention to the on the ground politics of identity while keeping a strong hand on what we lose if we don't hang on to the deep spiritual core humanity.
I love you. It's so funny. Like I always have just like a sense of people I need to talk to. And every time I don't know that person very well and I don't do a lot of research, it works out like this where I'm like, all right, now I'm really going to dig into all of your stuff, because everything that you said, I'm just, I always think about like, what does it take for a white person to really wake up and to be able to move past that performative? And man, I mean, I know you know this, we are at a time right now where it's so, the pull to be performative is so overshadowing the actual work that needs to be done. And so when I hear you in the process of like somebody pointed out like, hey, there's this stuff you have to look at. And then you were able to read Why Are All the Black Kids Sitting at the Cafeteria Together? You must have had some sort of ego strength online that gave you more space to be able to do that inquiry, because what I know I ran into in grad school, because when I was in grad school for social work, that was the first time I was introduced to racism, really. I mean, like, I'm from Cincinnati, so like Southern Ohio, we're like, well, everyone south of us is racist, but we're not racist, right? Like, that's what I was raised with. And so that first inquiry, my response to it was shame, which is what a lot of white people come to. And when I think about my progress, I had to build the capacity to tolerate being a bad person, right? Quote unquote, in order to be able to do the excavation that needed to be done. And because of the way the world is set up right now, that invitation is not there for everyone unless you choose it.
That is precisely why I made that comment about the fact that I was introduced to this work in a way that didn't ask me to see myself as a bad human.
Right. But we can even interpret that anyway, because no one told me I was bad. But just reading all the stuff, I shamed myself.
Well, I lived in shame for years. Mm-hmm. And so my story is not a clean story of immediately jumping in and saying, oh, this is such wonderful work. I'm so glad that my entire worldview is being torn down out from under me. That's not what happened. That is not what happened. I spent years being deeply shame filled and probably had a solid sense of self-hatred, you know, of just, I don't want to be white. I mean, the Witnessing Whiteness book does a lot of my storytelling of how I moved into cultural appropriation, how I sat within the amplifying and uplifting of people of color as the only knowers of anything. Because I could not imagine that white people had anything to contribute or say. I spent a lot of time there. The thing that facilitated it for me wasn't simple proximity, and it wasn't that I am some core wrong person. It's that I fell in love, and I fell in love with someone who wouldn't have me because I was white. And I had a real hard time with that.
Wow.
And the strength was me not wanting to give in to that and wanting to figure out what the hell did all of this mean? Because I was being told that in order to be fully appreciated by this person, that I needed to understand myself differently. So I tend not to hold a big stick over people who are simply handed a book and said, here, tear down your worldview. Go ahead, have a good time. The truth of the matter is most people do not jump themselves into an initiation process.
Yeah, right.
It befalls you more often than not. More often than not, if it is not part of your cultural frame. And initiation is not part of our US cultural frame, particularly not for white people. I now have this language of initiation, but I did get that that was happening to me. And boy, are there a lot of stories on that front. But I think the important thing to say about all of that is that by the time I started to put these pieces together and understand what I had gone through, and it is that model that is from Dr. Janet Helms that Beverly Daniel Tatum amplified and made very popular in those late 90s, I realized that I needed to pick up the call that she put forth, which was white folks need to have a different model. White folks need to know what they can aim toward, because that's the only thing that's going to get us up and moving. And so I have spent the last couple of decades of my life completely dedicated to helping other white people not do what I did.
Yeah.
Not have to do what I did. There's no reason for it to be as hard as it was for me. It's just not necessary. And I've now been part of white anti-racist community for long enough to know that with the right container, people can be both oriented toward, initiated into, and moved through with much less rigmarole. I mean, sure, is it still going to be transformative? Of course it is. Is that still going to be jostling and discombobulating? And might it still hurt? Of course. But this world hurts. And that's where that wounding absolutely comes in. Because for me, what I ended up landing into was, yes, it was all the shame stuff, but I was pissed. Because once I really realized that all of the educators and the elders in my environment had set me up to not be racially literate, to actually not be able to be loved by a person that I felt deeply invested in, I felt betrayed. And this is something I wanted to work on because I felt wronged. I knew that the harm that was coming to other white people was also significant. And that is, and this is another piece of language, that's the personal state. Now, admittedly, it took me a while to get to the point where I was equally balancing the fact that there are these structural issues we need to pay attention to versus the more personal orientation. And I now hold that as a both and pretty strongly and fairly well, but I moved through a much earlier phase where I did individualize these issues. That is no longer the crux of the conversation that we're having.
Right.
And that's both good and challenging. And right. So I'm ultimately going to like swing back and address where you kicked off. What's happening today?
Yep.
What's happening today from my vantage point? Because I started these conversations in the mid-90s, when there was absolutely a call to be paying attention to racial injustice from a systemic perspective. The language around white supremacy culture was not as fully there at the time. It was probably under the surface, but not mainstream by any stretch. But there was also a very strong push toward understanding racial identity development. That's significant because for all of us who either identify as educators or therapists or people invested in psychology, we know that part of our human development, part of our hierarchy of needs is having a sense of self that is stable.
Yep.
And we're not going to be able to build and do that other stuff that feels non-survival oriented unless we have that stability.
Right.
Well, social media.
Yep.
Has allowed, and this is not a blame, this is an amplification. We have had a last decade and a half of amplification of these issues through Black Lives Matter, call for immediate need for white people to wake up. We've got the conversation around white privilege and white fragility, making its advent into the public awareness. All of those things coming together have absolutely lit the fire under, hey, white people, not only do you have to do this, but you have to do it faster and better than you've ever done it before. And that's not wrong.
Right.
However, it butts up against the developmental aspect, which is what we currently have right now is, and I'm going to go into the third book now, which is the new book. Which, just FYI for listeners, the new book, the third book, is called Being White Today, A Roadmap for a Positive Anti-Racist Life. And what it has done is it has taken that model from Dr. Janet Helms, inspired by the updates that I received from Dr. Beverly Daniel Tatum, partnering with my co-author to say, okay, but now that we've worked with it for 15 years with a whole bunch of white people, we understand there are some dynamics and nuances that aren't in the original theory that we need to understand for today's purposes, because we need to know how to navigate that when we are in the different positionalities, because we go in and out of them. It's not a ladder. It's not a linear process. It is not a start here and end here and you're all good. It is very dynamic, in and out and up and down and back and forth and all sorts of stuff. So we created this visual of this model and then are moving through to explain all of this to basically say what we have got right now are people who are at middle stages of identity development and white people who are beating the hell out of other people who are not in the same position.
Yes.
And it is repelling from the movement.
Yes.
In ways that is deeply damaging and troublesome. And we've got a whole other cadre of people who think they're above it all.
Yes.
But are equally willing to take some delight in the push down of anybody else who's not on board because their psychological structure is not yet through the shame and guilt cycle.
Yes.
An awareness of it.
Have you been creeping on the therapist Facebook groups in Chicago, Shelly? Because, oh my God, you're reading our diary.
Yeah.
Do you know what's just around the corner? It's Anne's anniversary being part of Conversations with a Wounded Healer. And we are celebrating the anniversary with a giveaway. For anybody who wants to write an Apple Podcast review between March 6th and April 24th of 2024. So go to Apple Podcast, whether it's on your phone or your laptop, search for Conversations with the Wounded Healer, click on the show and scroll down until you see ratings and reviews. Tap write a review and tell us what you think about the show, especially how you think Anne adds to it. Then you'll screenshot your review and email it to me at sarah@headheartbiztherapy.com. I know you're thinking, what are the giveaways already? Well, very exciting. You will be entered into a drawing to win 1 hour sessions with both Anne and me. Anne will give you a choice between a private yoga class or a travel consultation session, which if you listen to the intro, she'll tell you more about that. And with me, you can choose between a 1 hour business coaching session or a Reiki session. Submissions must be received by 11:59 p.m. Central Standard Time on April 24th. The winner will be announced on social media on May 1st, and Anne and myself will reach out to you to schedule your sessions. So please enjoy our anniversary giveaway and celebrate our little Anne Remy. I mean, you see it clearly.
Very clearly. I mean, the other calling I have when I'm done with the job I am doing is white anti-racist therapist. No question.
Yeah, absolutely.
And we need many, many more of them. We need many, many, many therapists out there who are white and yes, understand the white experience, who can recognize what is happening for other white people, recognize where the shame and guilt is infused, even in ways that people do not realize, to be able to know, here are the next stages of where we can go, the next pieces, and here's what's necessary to pull us into a different way of being, because it's absolutely out there and available.
Yes.
Too many people do not have access to it. And one of the main limiters, there are lots of them, but a huge one is that in these middle zones of identity development, one of the key characteristics is our unending inability to recognize that we can't just believe and follow every single thing that a person of color says, regardless of who they are or where they are in their racial consciousness.
Yes, ma'am. That's it. I mean, like, literally, you are telling me exactly what has been unfolding on the Facebook groups right now. And it's so wild. One of my dear friends who is a therapist and a coach and a Black woman, and she was actually my intern. And so, like, we've had this beautiful, like, shift in our relationship from, like, me being the teacher to now her being a mentor for me. And she, I was telling her the foolishness that's happening. And she's like, 2020 was, like, the test. And for those of you who kept doing the work, like, those people are showing up now with grounding, with integrity, with a wider lens of what's going on. And the people who either, like, just didn't pay attention or they didn't keep doing their work, those are the people who are just coming at each other right now. And it's everything you're saying. There's this rallying around any person of color. And I'm seeing people of color perpetuate a lot of the same harm that was done to them before. And so I get it. It's a trauma response, right? And it's a natural part of their identity process. But we're therapists. And so I hold our behavior to a higher standard. And I don't think that all therapists do. There's such an interesting shift right now in what's happening, because younger therapists are going straight into private practice, whereas they couldn't do that when I graduated 15 years ago. It was just not an option. You went into community mental health where you had to be confronted with difference, right? They don't have that now. And all they see is, you know, the TikTok therapists on social media. And I'm scared. I'm scared for our profession. I'm scared for our people. And I'm mostly for the people that are being treated, right? The people who are coming to them. So what you said about, like, we need more white therapists who can do this work from an embodied, you didn't say this, but, like, I felt that embodied, that soulful, that grounded way. Holy shit, that's what we need. And that is not what's happening right now.
Well, you mentioned it, so I'll pick up on it. What I saw, I'll just say my analysis of what happened and my experience of summer 2020. So I am a person who has all my academic background in psychology, all my profession in education,
mm-hmm.
keeping in mind that none of this, other than the who I am, really shows up in my classes, because I'm not teaching mostly white people, but very, very much a part of a 20-year-old anti-racist white collective in Los mm-hmm. Angeles. And so here I sit in summer 2020, and I'm going to use the language from the book, the language of white Please. Identity development. What I saw was millions of people who were shaken out of a contact status, which is naivete, colorblind ideal, everything's all peachy keen, moved into the discombobulation of the disintegration process.
Yep.
And that disintegration process, and this is the added piece that Christine and I offer in our book, that disintegration process is bifurcated. The bifurcation is a back and forth. Where are you going to land? It's on one hand defending whiteness because that's the status quo. And that is what the rest of our environment is telling us is true and right and good and okay. Mm-hmm. And then there's this new orientation toward, wait, what's this anti-racist perspective? Wait, that thing I saw on the street was wrong. That right. person who was killed, that was wrong. And therefore, I'm now open to this anti-racist conversation. So I'm in swing and the world is on some level getting pulled out from under me. This was a collective initiation.
Yes.
Absolutely. Yes. 100% collective initiation. But here's what then happened. Number one, you all know this, therapists, dissonance doesn't stick around. It lands. The psyche has to resolve.
Yep. Yep.
And so I'm watching this. These people are going to resolve. They are going to make a decision on whether or not all this anti-racist language is the accurate version of truth.
Yeah.
Or if actually status quo is actually the better interpretation. And right. this was just one wrong, bad thing that happened on right. one street. And so I'm watching the newsreels. I'm watching the protest movement. I'm watching the interviews from activists. And what I am watching is millions of people beginning to recognize that the primary message is this isn't just about one person. This is racial injustice writ large. This is systemic. And all of your instincts that say, yeah, but that part is wrong. Yeah, but don't do that. Yeah, but this shouldn't be allowable. All of that is mixed up in the dissonance phase here.
Yeah.
And my interpretation is the people who had the supportive conversations or the insight, not the dedication, but the supportive conversation that allowed them to understand the systemic structuring of it in a way that didn't make them all wrong and bad could land on the toward anti-racism side of disintegration, moving into a reintegration status.
Right.
That doesn't make them healthy. It just makes them realizing that there's something to be done. So let's bracket that for 1 second, because that doesn't mean they were healthy.
I see where you're going.
It just means they got that there's something wrong and they're not going to move back away from that.
Yeah.
But here's what really kept me every day, all day long at my computer, trying to pull people into the activist circles that I'm a part of, which I believe are healthier than some. That other side of disintegration, which is defending whiteness, that's the one where but that was just one person. That was just one bad apple. Yeah, but look at all that destruction. This is really their fault. They could have been this. It could have been that. All of the excuses that cause somebody to end up landing on the, I'm not going to let my world completely fall apart because I have enough backing that tells me that I can be a decent person and not want somebody killed in the street. And still believe that all these anti-racist people are way too far, too extreme. And so I'm going to stay over here because that's pushing me away. And heaven help them if they've had an interaction that told them to go away, that they weren't valuable anyway, or that they had nothing valuable to contribute. And there's another version of reintegration. And they are very opposite of one another.
Yeah.
And here's the thing. And this is my like jump off point. And I will then let you speak, which is reintegration is more solid and more stable because it's been considered. Think about what that means from 2020 to 2023.
Right.
Lots and lots of people woke up to paying attention to race, and way too many of them landed on the side that is deeply, deeply unfortunate.
Right.
And sure, there are lots of people who woke up who will vote more correctly now than they would have before. And they might tolerate and know some things, but they are not active right now. They might be gotten to again, though. And that's where they may still be in the circle of anti-racism, even if they're not currently showing up. That's what I saw happening.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and it just speaks to my echo chamber of therapist. Like, of course, most of the people that I saw ended up on the anti-racism side. But as you said, not all of it is healthy, right? And I'm guessing, kind of to your point about, right, there's the camp of people who got stuck in, you know, just defending whiteness, camp of people in anti-racism. My fear is because of the bifurcation now that's happening within the anti-racism community, especially after October 7th, is that we are going to be fighting each other so much that the people defending whiteness are the ones who are going to win the next election, right? Like, yeah, that's my fear.
Yeah, that's a real fear. That's a real fear. And that's the thing, is moving around the, we call it a roundabout. Think of it like with cars, think about a roundabout. Yeah. Now think about a super, super messy one that has all sorts of different circles around a primary roundabout. And that's what we're working with here, because we got people stuck in different circles all the way around.
Yes.
And when you see this image, most of it are the circles around anti-racism, because there are not just one or two or a cleaving between two different anti-racisms. It's actually way more complicated.
Right.
There's actually a bunch of different positions.
Right.
And you are absolutely right. And it is at least half the battle that Christine and I were working on, that we've been watching for 15 years, absolutely ahead right now, no doubt. We've got lots of people within the anti-racism movement who are speaking past one another in ways that is less than helpful.
Yeah.
And that's actually where the structure of this text comes in, because not only is it kind of chapter by chapter following people through these different positions, but it's naming at this particular position, pick one, at each of the positions, what are the anti-racist messages that are not landing well?
Right. Right.
And then which are the ones, and then what can we do? Because they land well differently in a different position.
Right.
But then what are the far right messages that are actually creating some trouble for us? And that's really what Christine and I have been paying attention to starting in, I'd say, about 2017.
Mm-hmm.
We were seeing things, this goes back into some different storytelling, but we were witnessing the uplift of the white nationalists in a way that was really effective in their recruitment before it burst into the mainstream.
Yep.
And we were looking at this for a few years thinking, how do we help people navigate this? How do we help people navigate the conversations they need to have given the complexity of all of this?
Right.
And so what we are currently seeing with the splitting on the left also needs to take into account the way that it is being manipulated on the far right.
Yep.
And that open door for undermining all of what we want and are trying to do is so real.
You're just brilliant. And I am so glad we had this conversation. Yeah, I am like reverberating with all of the truth and all of the wisdom. And I am so grateful to have met you and to like just to be able to hear how, I mean, you have this beautiful marriage of the spirituality and the academic like prowess that's necessary, I think, to really support people in navigating this. Like, I mean, this is definitely the hardest time since I've been alive. You know, I had a former therapist who would say the 60s for her was the worst time, right? But for now in my lifetime, this is it. And therapists are falling apart. I can tell you that. And so I cannot wait to download all of your books and be directing everybody else to them too. I guess sort of a final question is like, what is bringing you hope right now in a world that feels hopeless?
Yeah. I'm going to bypass the hope part.
Sure.
I am going to offer what keeps me solid.
Love it.
Because I'm not in a point of where I can authentically name hope.
Yeah.
I mean, sure, I hope, but what I feel, I don't feel hope. I want hope. I hold on to hope, but I don't feel the hope.
Yeah.
But I still feel solid.
Yeah.
And what keeps me solid is a deeply metaphysical foundation of the following. One is that I know that I am part of a gigantic wave of people who care
yes.
and want and are doing this work. I may not know all of them. I may not be collectively involved with all of them, but I know I am one of a huge wave of people.
Yes.
So I don't feel alone, but I am operating with people. So there is a community element that keeps me strong, and that's essential for anybody in this, right? Second part is that I happen to be more of a reincarnation kind of gal in terms of my belief system.
Same.
And so I have been for many years understanding that our evolution is long. And I don't need to go into all of my metaphysics to talk about my grand understanding of what I think our collective human evolution means. But even just to use a bit more common terminology of our evolution of human consciousness. But essentially, I do believe that we are part of something and mm-hmm. that my soul has something to give to this time period. Mm-hmm. And so that makes me as a white-bodied person meaningful.
Yeah.
I find meaning in the birth of myself as a white person. I don't see it as a mistake. I don't see mm-hmm. just the socialization as something to sit in with trauma. I say, I have an opportunity. I actually was gifted this opportunity to make a difference. Mm. Because from an ancestral standpoint, my deep ancestry is not it partially white in terms of my DNA currently, but my larger ancestry from a reincarnation standpoint, that's bringing all sorts of lessons.
Right.
And so I'm not caught up with just, oh, I'm a white person. Here's how I suck.
Yeah.
Like, no, I got a gift to bring and I better do my job. So I have to do my job. I'm not going to see the end of it,
right?
But I'm a part of a whole bunch of people who are doing a lot. And that lets me sleep at night, even though what I understand is that the trauma is so vast and so deep. I am not the primary person experiencing the trauma. And I get that. I understand all the privileges around it, but that's more of a motivator to keep in my work rather than something to put me into a shame spot. Because there's an activist at one point who very clearly, and I don't remember the name, it's been passed down by other activists, but this is like from the 60s kind of thing. You can't be just thinking about the end goal. And too many white people just look at the end
goal.
Like if we can't see ending racism in the next 5 years, then somehow we should all just jump off a cliff. Like, no. We have to be in it because this is the moral clarity we have about what it means to be alive on the planet. And it is the journey that is making the difference. And if enough of us are in the journey, then the difference can be made. And I say this and two other things are coming up for me. And one of them is my father will eventually listen to this at some point. So here's my nugget for dad. Okay, dad. So here's the thing. Dad has a tendency to try to offset my pragmatic, reality-based orientation with hopefulness.
Mm-hmm.
My answer to my dad's hopefulness that does not necessarily always come with the action that I would like to see is born from beautiful writer, African-American historian, Carol Anderson. If you have not read the book, White Rage, you to read it.
Yeah.
It is a 5-part series of here is how our U.S. history trajectory has moved, not in a linear uplift way, but in a back and forth pendulum kind of way.
Yep.
Now, here's the thing. I'm a both and kind of gal. So I see it as both. So now I've got this layered linearity with the pendulum swing.
Yep.
So I still think we're better off than we were in the 1860s, right? And we are in a deep backlash.
Yes.
But if anything history teaches us is that where that pendulum swing ends is not given.
Right.
We have to work for it if we want to come out on the better end of that swing.
Right.
So this is the rallying cry for all of us to not get bogged down. The hope is in attaching to community, understanding the history, recognizing that we have got a role to play that is sizable and important and keeps us moving ourselves toward the better place.
Yeah.
That's what keeps me solid.
Goddamn. I mean, I feel like I just got the best sermon that I needed for today. Seriously. I'm just so grateful to be in connection with you. And I hope that that can continue after today because you're just, your work, not only your academic work, but your personal work just is so clear and is so, it is so solid. I see it so beautifully. So thank you for sharing it with the listeners today. And how can they find you?
Easiest way, if you can spell my name right, shellytouchlick.com. So Shelly with a Y, not an E. So S-H-E-L-L-Y. And then Touchlick is pronounced not like it sounds. So it's T-O-C-H-L-U-K.com. And then just email me. I'm pretty easy to find. And I do tend to, I collect anti-racist friends. And so I would love to stay in community. I think we all need each other. I think we need to have the people who can move us toward the resources that are going to be helpful and healing while we do that tearing down of whiteness work, because white people are perfectly fine. Whiteness as a socialized consciousness is what we want to tear down. Don't want to tear down the people.
Yeah. Amazing. Thank you, Shelly.
Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure talking to you.
Thanks to our guest for an amazing conversation today. To find out more about today's guest, you can visit www.headheartbiztherapy.com/podcast.
You can find Sarah at Head Heart Biz Therapy on Facebook and Instagram.
And you can find Anne at Spare Room Wellness or spareroomwellness.com.
Thanks as always to Andrea Klunder and the Creative Imposter Studios for editing, to Liam O'Donnell for the album art, and to Ben Mueller for our theme music. Until next time, bye-bye.